Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
As we're out there having these conversations with believers, I think it's important that when we talk about the Bible, when we quote the Bible, we refer to specific verses and scriptures in the Bible. We have to make sure that we're getting it right. The conversation today is the product of an exchange I had on Twitter with Dr. Joshua Bowen. He's written a book which just came out. It's called Did the Old Testament Endorse Slavery? Dr. Bowen is a graduate of Johns Hopkins. He has a PhD in Assyriology. He specializes in the Sumerian language. He also has a BS in religion. He's got a theology degree in the Old Testament from Capital Bible Seminary. He's co-host of the YouTube channel Digital Hammurabi. That and all of his links are in the description box of the broadcast, by the way. On the show and on his pages, he is probably best known as Dr. Josh. He was even a chaplain in the United States Air Force before he ultimately walked away from his religion. And we had this online exchange where he was talking about how sometimes when we get into the book of Exodus and Leviticus and we talk about slavery, we may be getting a few of the details wrong. And I think that's important. Accuracy is important. Getting the context right is important. So I wanted to get Dr. Bowen's perspective, and he joins me on the show right here, right now. Do I call you Dr. Josh? I mean, how do I refer to you for the purposes of our conversation?
Dr. Josh is great.
Dr. Josh Bowen, tell me about, what are you a doctor of? Let me tell you, what's your PhD in?
I have a PhD in Assyriology from Johns Hopkins University with a minor in Hebrew Bible.
Help me out. Assyriology?
The languages and cultures of ancient Iraq and Syria. So, you know, if you think about the Sumerians, the Akkadians, that was our specialization. So from about 3000 BCE to 300 BCE, about the time of Alexander, that's where my focus is.
I mean, how does one get there? You're like, you know what I'd like to study in depth is this incredibly niche and sort of, I mean, forgive me, but it's kind of a nerdy, you know what I'm saying?
It is definitely nerdy. The nice thing about it, though, is I got there through my fundamentalist evangelicalism. So I went to Liberty University and got my bachelor's in religion. And then I wanted to become an Air Force chaplain. So I started attending this conservative seminary out in just outside of DC called Capital Bible Seminary to get my master's of theology in Old Testament studies. And while I was there, I started taking, you know, really, really focusing in on Hebrew and other Semitic languages like Ugaritic and Akkadian and Syriac and Aramaic, those sorts of things. And all of those, the cultural context of the Old Testament, I guess ultimately of the Bible, is the ancient Near East, is ancient Iraq and the languages and cultures that, you know, stem from there. So
did you get into it for the purposes of apologetics? I want to go out and defend the faith kind of thing.
Yeah, no question. As a matter of fact, I taught Hebrew my last 2 years at seminary, and the dean, I got accepted to Johns Hopkins on a full scholarship, and the dean pulled me aside maybe the week before I was about to go in and said, are you nervous? You're getting ready to go into the lion's den there at that liberal university. And I had my Hebrew Bible in my hand and I held it up and I said, I'm going in, but I'm going to win souls for Christ.
You were that guy.
I was that guy.
Would you say you know the Bible better now than you did when you were a believer?
Oh, no question.
It's an interesting phenomenon. You probably bumped into that quite a bit. Like, I thought I knew my Bible, But now on the other side of the looking glass, I actually know the Bible better. Probably, I mean, it's certainly in your case, better than most of the people who are the champions of the Bible, right?
It's scary the way that it works out because, you know, as the old saying goes, it's only, I guess it's not that old of a saying if I can't come up with it, but you don't know shit until you know that you don't know enough to know shit. And that's really what happened when you get into a sort of a graduate program and you start to realize that this very narrow approach that you've taken to the Bible, this narrow interpretation, this King James only or, you know, something akin to it.
It's not objective study. It's more of like you're being trained to defend. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. And that was the, I suppose that was the interesting thing about it is depending on what hermeneutical approach you take, you know, which denominational approach or apologetic that you have, you know, mine was very specific. So I was a dispensationalist. And if you asked me to defend it, I had this set path of biblical text that I would run you through. And I could do it so well that I sounded like, and I certainly believed, that I knew my Bible inside and out. And the problem is that it's sort of a house of cards. Each piece is built upon another. And if one of them goes down, the whole thing goes down, unfortunately.
I have a new book coming out, and I said in the book, an interesting point that most people don't realize is that no one has ever read the Bible. Like, none of us have ever read the Bible. We read an oral tradition of a copy, of a translation, of a transcription, of a copy. I mean, I don't know. Would you agree with that? Is that an overstatement? Like, none of us have really read whatever the Bible was supposed to be, right?
Yeah, I've got a series on our channel, Digital Hammurabi, where I go through where did the Bible come from? And it's basically a walkthrough of textual criticism in the Old Testament and then the New Testament. And, you know, we don't have any of the originals, right? We don't have, you know, where first Isaiah's pen went to scroll or whatever it is that he put it on. What we have are hundreds of years later, you know, a manuscript tradition that came down to the Dead Sea Scrolls at Qumran, and then, of course, the later Masoretic tradition, which is 1,200 years later than that. So what we have are the result of scribes copying and recopying out these texts and compiling them. And while I wouldn't say that we can't have, you know, I hate to use the word faith here, we can't have any faith or, you know, assurance of, to some degree that what they copied is reasonably accurate. I think it probably is. We know about scribal traditions during earlier periods. And, you know, it's reasonably accurate. I think the problem that you would run into and that I certainly ran into is when you take this inerrancy position where every letter, every grammatical morpheme is inspired and preserved by God. That becomes very problematic.
Which is the position of all the major Christian denominations, at least in the United States. If you go to their mission statements, they say it is absolutely true and, quote, without error. That's the position of the Baptists. To a degree, the Methodists, I know the Assemblies of God have that. You know, they say it's error-free, blemish-free. It's perfect, right?
Yeah. And there's a nice, I suppose there's an easy out for it in that they will often assign that, not always, but they will often assign that inerrancy to the autographs. So, you know, what Jeremiah or, you know, what Moses wrote, of course, Moses didn't write it, but, you know, it goes back to the original autographs, which in and of itself is problematic. But because we don't have any of the autographs, then they can allow for some slight corruptions or copying errors or those sorts of things to come in. It kind of is a backdoor to allow you to get out of things that are really problematic.
Well, I also hear just think of them like in reporters. You know, they report from a scene from different vantages, which explains why the Gospels have all these sort of different vantages on Jesus. I mean, from their perspective, well, of course, he didn't see it that way. Or, of course, Jesus's last words may not have been heard this way by this person. So these reporters may have been reporting accurately from their vantage. Have you run into that apologetic?
Oh, sure. And I mean, you know, there's a certain truth to that. The problem is that when that is used to explain what are clearly contradictory statements. Of course, my specialization is in the Old Testament, but you know, you see this. We had Dr. Joel Baden on our channel recently, who's up at Yale Divinity School, and he works on how the Pentateuch, how the original, you know, the five books, the first five books of the Bible came together in the state that we have them. And part of the reason that that study exists is because there are contradictions all over the place. So, you know, utilizing something like different perspectives to try to explain contradictory statements is problematic at best.
Talking here with Dr. Josh Bowen, he is an expert, really, in the ancient Near East and the Hebrew Bible. He has studied in depth the Old and the New Testament. The guy knows his scripture. Where did the first five books of the Bible come from? I mean, I'm not asking you to, like, try to boil it down in 5 minutes, but can you boil it down in 5 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it, not Moses. It's this sort of the big thing. So, you know, for a long time, there was this idea that Moses, you know, put together the Pentateuch, the Torah. But we, you know, most, in fact, I would say the vast majority, the consensus view of scholars in the field would agree wholeheartedly that this was a group of either individual sources or smaller texts brought together. This is an edited work. And, you know, if you go to our channel, Joel Baden talks extensively about this. So that his idea, and not his idea, but the theory that's incredibly common is called the documentary hypothesis. And essentially it says that there were four original sources, four complete sources, four stories, three stories definitely that went from Genesis to, you know, from creation to getting ready to go into the land of Israel. And, you know, through the Exodus, through the wanderings, you know, Mount Sinai, all those things. And they were three different traditions that were written down, and someone at the end came along and kind of wove them all together with this other source called the Deuteronomist. But it's taking these stories that were written down by different groups of people, probably over quite some time, and weaving them together to form this story. And the reason that we know that, I mean, everybody agrees that there are different sources, there are different parts. The disagreement is, were they woven together all at the end? Is there, you know, sort of layers that were placed? You know, people came by and put another layer of text, and then later another editor put another layer of text, how that all happened. But it's not that Moses, not it's not that one man sat down and penned, you know, what he received from on high. These are later traditions that are being intricately woven together.
I want to get into slavery, which is really the reason we started talking about talking, right? We're like, hey, wait, no, some of our, the activists and counter-apologetics out there about slavery may be wrong. And I'm interested in that. I want to make sure that we are arguing against, you know, these bad ideas, but doing so in the correct way, in the correct context, with the correct arguments. I want to get to slavery, okay? But let's bounce back to Liberty University. I'm not going to ask you to throw your old college under the bus, but I will ask you, is it a cult? Dr. Josh.
It's interesting. My older sister went to Liberty, got her education there. I was in the Air Force at the time, and they had a really good distance learning program that worked well for me. So I don't feel like I got the indoctrination, perhaps, that others did. I didn't need it at the time. I was incredibly fundamentalist. And so I didn't need any further indoctrination. I suspect had I gone to Liberty that I would have been considered extreme to them.
For my international listeners or people who aren't familiar, Liberty University was founded by Jerry Falwell, who was an evangelical. He was wired in with politicians, President Ronald Reagan and others. He had founded the Moral Majority. He was on this moral fight against what he considered to be these sort of you know, the decline of Western civilization, the attack of Satan upon the entire nation. He was part of the Satanic Panic, where everything was satanic. He had a huge anti-gay agenda. And so when he founded Liberty University, it was sort of this microcosm of his values, which it was extremely restrictive. And it was very much a fundamental Christian biosphere. Would you agree with that assessment,
John? Oh, yeah, no question. You know, my sister likes to tell the story. They weren't allowed to go watch rated R movies, or I don't even know that they were allowed to watch PG-13 movies, like out in the theaters. And I can't remember what movie it was. It might have been one of the Terminator movies. I'm not sure. But it was coming out, and everybody on campus, you know, all the rebels wanted to go sneak off and see it. And there was this class that everybody had to take, and it was called Jesus is Awesome. Like, that was the name of the class. And the instructor, I had to take it, distance learning. And in the video that I watched, in every class, the professor, and I can't remember his name, would like sort of slide into the middle of the room, and he'd say, Jesus is what? And the whole class, you know, what, 900 people or whatever it was, would wow. go, awesome! In every class. So all these kids snuck out to go watch this rated R movie. And one of the RAs got wind of it. And as the lights went down in the theater, this big IMAX theater, she walks down to the front and turns around and says, Jesus is what? And the whole room went, awesome. And she said, I'm from Liberty University. And the whole place just cleared. So, yeah.
Wait a minute. Everybody left?
Everybody because they were out? Terrified. Yeah, they were terrified that they were going to get turned in and receive punishment. So, yeah, I think that calling it sort of this insulated cult-like place is not too far off.
There was somebody I knew was going to Oral Roberts University here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, my hometown. And she was talking about how one of her classes was called Christian Worldview. And I thought to myself, you know, this is really a great example of being taught what to think instead of how to think. Because the class was saying, well, this is what you think about the world. This is what you think about your country and your neighbors and your politicians and your life and your loves and your future, downloading this sort of propaganda. You know, it really was a proactive force in trying to decide for other people who they should be. There was a lot of that at Liberty, right?
Yeah, no question. And furthermore, with that download, I think came the defense. Yeah. So, okay. And so here's what you believe. Now, you're going to hear people say X to try to convince you otherwise. But here's the response to that. And, you know, so building in this apologetics comes part and parcel. And, you know, from that perspective, when you believe, you know, we had John Collins, who is a biblical scholar, come on our channel a couple of weeks ago. And he said something that was very insightful. And that was, when you have this sort of fundamentalist approach to the biblical text where you know that you're right and there is no option, you know that you're right. The Holy Spirit is in you and he's guiding you into truth. And so there is no possibility that you've gotten that wrong because the Holy Spirit, you know, bears witness with you. When you're in that position, then you feel compelled. You feel absolutely compelled to not only proclaim that truth, but to make sure that others see it. And he said, when you're in a place where you know that you're right and you know that the others are wrong and they're not listening, leaves no room for negotiation. And that's when violence ensues. And I thought it was actually very appropriate given what we've seen through history. And of course, even now, just this intolerance, complete intolerance for anything that does not agree with your very nuanced position.
The internet is not known as nuance central. That's another probably piece of that puzzle. It's hard. You know, when you look out, I think people expect either or, like there can't be more than one truth or one fact or at least one focus at the same time. And it often cheats us. I want to get into your perspective on some key things in the Bible from this other side, right? You've managed to crawl out of the bubble. And, you know, you probably did so at great cost. I mean, have you paid any kind of a personal price? Have you heard back from people who are now praying for your immortal and damned soul? Any of that stuff going on? Or am I being too dramatic?
No, every day. I know that people are praying for me every day. And there's a part of me that feels, a large part of me that feels incredibly awful for what they're going through, because I remember being in that position. And from their perspective, I'm going to hell. Now, I think there are some that would say that, you know, given we had a, you know, very strong eternal security background, so once saved, always saved. So I think there are many people that take some comfort in the fact that because I trusted Christ, the Holy Spirit has sealed me. And so I'm going to heaven. I'm just in a backslidden state, and someday I will come back to the faith. So I think that gives some consolation perhaps to them. But yeah, I've lost family over this. You know, I'm sure the same as many other people that have gone through this, but of course, many, many friendships, which is sad. But
it reveals a kind of conditional love, I guess. Like, I will love you, but if you can't validate or agree with me, maybe they see it as tough love.
Yeah, it's. I think in their minds, it's more. I love you, but I have to now distance myself from you because you've fallen away from the faith, and you know you're always welcome back, and we're going to pray that you come back. But as you say, like a tough love, you know, until you do, it's you know we can't be around you.
I was always interested in the eternal security versus you could lose your salvation argument because I was confronted with the question. Well, all right, if once saved, always saved. I said the salvation prayer. Now I'm guaranteed nothing can ever strip my salvation, even if I become an atheist or do whatever I'm doing. If that's the case, what are the consequences for me being an atheist activist? Like, are there fewer jewels in my crown? Is my mansion smaller? Am I reduced in class when I go to heaven? I don't know. Have you navigated that? Like, what does that mean? Like, if I reject Christ on earth, what are the consequences when I go to heaven, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that we actually ever needed to go down that path because the assumption is that you were never really saved, right? So while we could entertain logically the possibility that someone could backslide, the reality is we would assume, we would conclude that really, when you say that you said the sinner's prayer or that you trusted Jesus or whatever, that you didn't really do that.
The no true Scotsman.
Yeah, argument. I mean, certainly because, see, by their fruits, they will be known, right? So we know that, you know, someone who has had the Holy Spirit come and indwell them, someone who has trusted Christ for their salvation, there's going to be, while there's a doctrinal problem with that, and we would maybe wrestle with the doctrinal problem, the assumption is in reality that if the person didn't change, if the person just immediately or even in the long term went back to unbelief, well, then highly likely that they were just never really saved. And if they were, then God will bring them back.
Now, I wondered if it was just a coping mechanism. How does a moral person jive with the idea of eternal torment? I think they find a mechanism by which you won't go to hell. So, you know, what he said, the salvation prayer when he was 4. So now I don't have to worry about him, or I don't have to reconcile the morality of hell or go through any of these sort of, you know, acrobatics to worry about it. Now, in my mind, I believe he's going to be okay. We can just take that off the table. I always wondered if that was part of the motivation.
Or, you know, the one that I've heard now that I've been on YouTube very commonly is nobody goes to hell that doesn't want to go, which is one of the goofiest apologetics I think I've ever heard.
Light her up, man.
I really want to. I mean, it's such a silly notion.
Yeah. God doesn't send you to hell. You choose to go to hell. Yeah. I want to talk about slavery in the Bible. I will continue my conversation with Dr. Josh Bowen in just a second. Hang on. More and more, as our routines are changing, people are discovering the unique and powerful app that brings thousands of wonderful nonfiction bestsellers directly to your phone, tablet, or web browser, and allows you to digest entire books in about 15 minutes. It's called Blinkist, and it's awesome. Blinkist boils these books down to the best key takeaways, which you can read or listen to in audio format. Blinkist also has full-length audiobooks at specially discounted prices if you're interested in taking a deeper dive into the material that you're interested in. Topics range from self-improvement to business management to nutrition, personal growth, biographies, so much more. You ought to check out Dr. Jamie Metzl's fascinating book about hacking into our genome, creating a future that's beyond natural selection. The book is called Hacking Darwin. Given the economy these days, I got interested in Thomas Wood's book called Meltdown. It's about the 2008 stock market crash and the negative impact of the government bailouts. It's relevant stuff. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Seth to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership and up to 65% off audiobooks, which are yours to keep forever. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/Seth to get 25%
25% off a premium membership and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Seth. An interesting conversation. We talk a lot about the Bible. We, as counter-apologists, are out there often referring to the Bible. I have Dr. Josh Bowen. He is an expert in ancient Near East Hebrew, and he studied extensively the Old Testament and the New Testament. Really, he's got a perspective, I think, that we could benefit from. So, all right, I'm out there and I'm quoting Exodus chapter 20, verses 20 and 21, where we talk about beating your slaves. Right. First of all, we are trying to establish that Yahweh said slavery was okay. He endorsed the owning of another human being as property. On top of that, you are allowed as the master to beat the slave to the point of unconsciousness without consequence, and if the slave is able to get up and walk away after a couple of days. Now, I'm paraphrasing here, Josh. But, you know, you and I were kind of having an exchange back and forth on this subject, and there are some things in regard to the slavery argument or the slavery analysis of the Old Testament that you say that we are kind of getting wrong, or we're not perhaps interpreting or expressing correctly. Can you walk me down this path, and you can tell us where to begin? What's the problem?
Yeah, I don't know that I would say that people are necessarily getting it wrong. I think maybe there's an emphasis where there shouldn't be. So let's take that passage in Exodus 21, just to kind of lay out what it means, what scholars would say that it means. If a man beats his male and female slave, or male or female slave, with a wooden rod, and the slave dies immediately, the assumption is that more than discipline or more than chastisement, whatever, more than what you would do for a normal slave or a normal child, you know, beating them with a rod, which is absolutely encouraged in the biblical text, it would be assumed that if they died immediately, that something more was intended by the master. There was malice involved. So murderous intent is what was most likely. So that's why the text says if they die immediately, then the master will be punished. The word nakam there in the Hebrew is kind of, it's a touchy word, debated word, because we have a really good word in that passage in the legal sections to talk about someone being put to death. And that's not that word. So that's why there's some debate. Does it mean, and if you look in your translations, you might see punished. Probably does mean to be killed, but there's debate about it. But there's something severe that's going to happen to the master if he kills the slave and if he beats him and they die immediately. However, if the slave survives for a day or two, which may mean that they survive and probably does mean that they survive a day or two and then die. If there is this period of time between the beating and the death, then mitigating circumstances are considered, right? It's the judges would say, okay, maybe something else resulted, some infection or something else was the cause of the slave dying. And so the benefit of the doubt is extended to the master. And so he's not punished. And what is the loss that he suffers? Well, he suffers the loss of his property, right? His money, his silver, is what the text says. So he's, you know, if he survives a day or two, then the master is not to be punished because he is his silver. He's his money. He's his property. So the idea here is, even though it's horrific to us, as well it should be, slaves were expected to be beaten with rods. If you read through Proverbs 29, for example, you'll see that a slave is not taught by words alone. Now, they won't understand words alone. The expectation is that you're going to beat them just in the same way that you beat children. Children, you know, if a father really loves his child in the Hebrew Bible, he beats them because that brings them into conformity with correct behavior. So, but those verses, I think approaching it, if we're trying to get at authorial intent, if we're trying to get at, you know, what the law was there for, you can approach it from at least two perspectives, right? You can either say, all right, masters, here's sort of a handbook for how to beat your slave senseless and get away, you know, like abuse them and get away with it. you can beat them as much as you want. Just make sure they don't die. Or if they do die, it takes a couple of days. That's one way of looking at it. And I think that's probably the incorrect way to look at it. I think the law is actually in place as a protection to the slave. So it's trying to mitigate abuse. The interesting thing about it is that's not unique to the Hebrew Bible. That's not unique to the Old Testament. I wrote a book called Did the Bible Endorse Slavery? And one of the things that the book does is compare slavery laws to the wider ancient Near East. So, you know, if you've heard about the laws of Hammurabi or the Code of Hammurabi or any of these other laws from the ancient Near East, looking at those, looking at court cases from the ancient Near East that we actually have the original tablets of, and saying, how does it compare? What do we see? And actually, we see similar protections, sometimes greater protections, in the wider ancient Near East than we do here in the Hebrew Bible. So I just think it's a matter at times of perspective and what to emphasize.
Now, somebody on Twitter hears a fraction of that, and they think, you're trying to let the slave owner off the hook. You're saying that we need to look at what's the intent of the law. The slave owner had essentially, for lack of a better way of saying it, a spare the rod, spoil the slave attitude toward discipline.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I co-host on a show called The Schuyler Fiction Show. And one of the things that we do all the time is to try to look at the Old Testament text and say, is this consistent with a perfect being in whom we can ground our morality, right? In other words, is this a morality that we should be adhering to and that we should be saying it's objective and it never changes? It's this immutable, if it's good back then, it's good now type of morality. And of course it's not, right? Of course it's not. The problem is that from a Christian apologetic standpoint, often because the idea is that morality is grounded in God's nature, or in his commands, whatever people would say, that you can't have things in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, that depict God doing something that we would today consider to be immoral, because morality is supposed to be set, right? It's not supposed to be developing and changing. And so my point in looking at something like slavery is, besides just trying to say, look, let's get at what it actually was, what it looked like, which often is motivated by apologists trying to downplay it and to make it seem like a kinder, more gentle slavery, which of course it was not. It's also to say, or maybe ultimately to say, look, this isn't good. It's not a morality that we should be, you know, striving for. It's one that we should be leaving behind.
There are a couple of angles that I hear on the slave question when it comes to the Christian Bible. The first is indentured servanthood. I mean, these weren't slaves. These were people paying off a debt or working in good faith for a quote-unquote master. It was kind of a feudal system to a degree back then, and the word slave is really an unfair word. Dr. Josh, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, there are basically two types of slavery in the ancient world, in the ancient Near East and in the Hebrew Bible, and they're all pretty consistent throughout. Those are debt slaves and chattel slaves. So normally when you read through the biblical passages that relate, that are legal sections, Exodus 21 and Deuteronomy 15, even a great, you know, a large portion of Leviticus 25, the three main passages that are in the legal sections that talk about slavery, you're dealing with Israelite slaves, right? You're dealing with the laws for fellow Hebrews, fellow Israelites that are taken as slaves. In Exodus 21, which is arguably the earliest, and in Deuteronomy 15, you can take Hebrew slaves, and they're taken as debt slaves. So, you know, if I'm working for you, Seth, and I take out a loan and I can't pay it back, and I owe you, let's say, 30 shekels of silver. Well, I don't have it, right? I had two bad years of crops and I can't come up with the money. I become a debt slave to you, right? So you're not going to pay me. I'm not going to, you know, come work for you. I'm going to be your slave, right? I'm going to be your, and we don't necessarily make a contract per se, because the law sets out what the terms are for it already. But I become your debt slave. And so I come in and the law says that I have to work for you for 6 years. And in the seventh year, you set me free. Now, there are lots of different little caveats with that, but that's the basic premise. So In Exodus 21, when I go free, that's it. I go free. In Deuteronomy 15, a later text, you set me free after the sixth year, but you have to provide all kinds of things for me. You have to give me food, and you have to give me wine, and you have to give me, in other words, you're giving me provisions so that the chances are I'm not going to fall back into poverty, into debt slavery. But these are for fellow Israelites. These are for their brethren, right? When you get to Leviticus 25, the script has been flipped, right? The person that wrote this section called the Holiness Code, the priestly writer, he now says, if a fellow Israelite becomes so impoverished that they sell themselves to you, you are not allowed to treat them as a slave. The Hebrew word there that's been used is eved. You know, in Exodus 21 and Deuteronomy 15, it's a slave. It's an eved. It's an eved. You can't treat them that way anymore. You have to treat them as a hired worker. So you have to pay them wages. They're still in the position, sort of a slave. They can't just go free, but they're now being paid. And they work until what's called the 50th year, the year of Jubilee, and then they're sent back to their land. But again, these are all Israelites. So the other type of slavery that we see is chattel slavery, and chattel just meaning movable property. The difference between a chattel slave and a debt slave at its very basic form is a debt slave is slavery that's contingent upon a debt. So when the debt is paid, slavery ends. Chattel slavery is not contingent upon a debt, so it continues on indefinitely. So when you read passages like Leviticus 25, 44 to 46, the one that we're all familiar with, you know, if you want male or female slaves, you get them from the nations around you. You get them from, you know, foreigners that are tenant farmers in your midst in the land of Israel. Those become your property. Those you keep and pass down as inheritance to your children. Those you keep forever. These are chattel slaves. And the distinction is that they're not Israelites. They're foreigners.
In the context of the Bible, then, they are dehumanized in a way?
I wouldn't, from our standards, absolutely. I don't think that they would have thought that from their standards, given how common slavery was.
It was more of a class system for them then.
I think it was just a way of life. I'm hesitant with the word class because we see some distinctions.
Yeah, I'm struggling for the word myself, but, you know, but it's certainly part of their normal. There is a sect of people who are earmarked for this role in society. Would that be a more accurate way?
Okay. Yeah, chattel slaves were marked in the ear. So, I mean, they said, so.
I just stumbled into that reference, my friend.
But the thing is, you know, it wasn't necessarily the case that only a foreigner could be a chattel slave. So, for example, if you go back to Exodus 21, you know, those first six verses, it talks about if a man sells himself, if he becomes a female slave and sells himself, or you acquire this Hebrew slave, he'll serve for 6 years and then he'll go out free in the seventh. If he comes in with a wife, and I'm going to paraphrase too because I don't have it in front of me, but if he comes in with a wife, when he goes free with his wife. However, if when he comes in, he's single and the master gives him a wife, ostensibly another slave, and they have children, when in the seventh year, when he goes out after the 6 years of service, the wife and the children are the property of the master. They belong to the master. They don't go out with the husband, the father, the male slave. And so this sets up the circumstance for the slave to the then debt slave to say, all right, I love my master. I love my wife, my children. I want to stay and serve the master forever. And it's at that point that there's a ritual that takes place. There's an awl put through the ear, and that slave, you know, serves for life. But that child that was born to the two slaves is a chattel slave. It's what they call a house-born slave. And they're all over the place. You know, Abraham had them. You know, the author of Ecclesiastes had them, lots of them, right? I mean, it's incredibly common. But this is the big distinction, Israelites versus foreigners, generally speaking, is a debt slave versus chattel slavery distinction. And then debt slave and chattel slave and Israelite and non-Israelite. Those are sort of the categories that you end up seeing, and usually Israelites are debt slaves, and usually foreigners are chattel slaves. But there's some variation that can take place in there.
The other half of this sort of analysis is the apologetic that, well, it was a different time back then. I mean, it was a different culture that needed a sterner hand. It had to be approached in a different, what kind of an Old Testament way, we'd actually use the word. You know, these Old Testament times were more primitive. They were they required kind of some tougher restrictions and different types of laws in order to keep people in line. How would you approach that, and what's your perspective on it?
I mean, first of all, it's problematic simply from a moral standpoint, right? Because what you then have to argue is that it was okay to have slaves at the time, which is, I think, ridiculous.
But you know what? That was the culture at the time, Josh. I mean, that's the culture, and God was working within the framework of the culture that existed, speaking in the language that those people in that time period with that level of education, given those customs, would understand. He was actually trying to speak in their language. I'm playing devil's advocate here.
Sure, sure. Part of the problem, I think, is when you, I talked about Exodus 21 and Deuteronomy 15 being older law, you know, sections of legal text, and that Leviticus 25 is the latest of the three, arguably. In Exodus 21 and in Deuteronomy 15, you can have Israelite slaves. When you get to Leviticus 25, it's not allowed anymore. In slavery, being an eved is a bad thing in Leviticus 25. It talks about you were slaves in Egypt, so you're not going to be, my people are not going to be slaves anymore. You cannot treat your fellow Israelites this way. You have to treat them as hired workers. You can't treat them as slaves. So the text understands at this point that the priestly writer who's putting this together believes wholeheartedly that slavery is not good and says very clearly, you cannot treat Israelites this way. These are your brethren. And you can't treat them this way. So the argument that God was kind of working with them or something falls apart really in Leviticus 25, because if that were the case, right, and let's say that God has now sort of progressed through and now the people are ready to hear that slavery is bad, and so he's getting ready to abolish it. If the text ended in verse 43, I could say you've got a better case. The problem is that what God says is no more Israelite slaves. Now, if you want slaves, get them from the foreigners that are living around you or those tenant farmers that are living in the land of Israel, get them from them. So in other words, if you've got a tenant farmer that's, you know, an Edomite or something or a Moabite and is living in the land and they fall into debt with you and they have to sell themselves to you as a slave, you don't have to set them free at the year of Jubilee. They don't go free after 6 years. They don't go free at the 50th year. They're yours for life. So you would have to argue that God is doing this so progressively and at such a slow rate that he's actually doing it for his own people first, and with the giving them the moral example, I guess, that it's not good to do it to your own people. That's step one, but you can do it to other people. I mean, I just think it becomes incredibly problematic from a moral standpoint.
So beyond the, you're going to pay off a debt or you owe me, so you are now indebted as a slave to me. There are examples in the Old Testament of one superior tribe looking at another tribe or person and saying, okay, grab them. I mean, you know, they go in, they conquer a city, a region, whatever, and they just take people as slaves. Examples of that do exist in the scriptures.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a little more nuanced. It's certainly in Numbers 31, for example, you have cattle and women being listed as plunder, right? And they're being taken. That clearly an example that we would say these are slaves that are being brought back.
It's like when Moses' army goes in and they take even the virgin girls, right?
So if you, the big passage that people go to is in Deuteronomy and Deuteronomy 20 and into 21 as well. You know, you have a similar thing, but basically there are some marching orders, and those are when you approach a city that is outside of the chosen land, right? The nation of Israel proper. when you approach one of these cities that exist outside of Israel, you're to offer them peace, like a peace treaty. And if that city agrees, then they are to become your, the Hebrew word is mas. And what it means is it's tribute. It can be used for like corvée labor. In other words, they're not slaves proper to you. It's not like you're pulling them from that city and bringing them into your home. But the king of Israel, the Israelites can go and can say, all right, we want to build this building project. All of you, come on. You know, your conscripted labor, your corvée labor. However, if that city, so that's best case scenario for that city, best case. If they put up a fight, they say, no, we're not going to sign your peace treaty. We're not going to become your corvée labor, your vassals. Then you're to kill them. And that's just the city. Those are just the cities that are outside of Israel. Those that are inside of Israel are under the ban, right? So they're to be wiped out.
It sounds like the salvation message, right? Follow me or I'll burn you, kind of a deal.
Yeah. It's, again, from a moral, from an ethical standpoint, it's very difficult in my mind to try to reconcile those things if you're trying to hold that this is an immutable being who's, you know, has a morality that exists in his nature that is unchanging. Because what you end up having to argue is that even within the biblical text itself, you have conflicting voices about what's right and what's wrong. And I just think that's incredibly, incredibly problematic. And we should just let the text be what it is. And that is an ancient text that was written by humans, perhaps interacting with what they considered to be the divine. But this is a product of humans.
I think, too, it's fair to say that a God who sees everything, past, present, and future, a Jesus who is the same yesterday, today, and forever, wouldn't write a book that goes out of date. I mean, you and I wouldn't have to say, well, you know, in the context of the, you know, Old Testament Israelites given this and doing this, and historically this was happening to them, and their education level was this, and they used to think this, and, you know, for 21st century planet Earth, it seems God would have created a mechanism for communication that was absolutely relevant up to the second and would be timeless as well. I think that's a fair position, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the problem. I think that we expect things from texts that they were never intended to do. So looking at the Hebrew Bible for it, my wife's a Christian, for example. She's Anglican from the UK. And none of this bothers her. Right. If she would say, she went to Hopkins as well, and she understands ancient Near Eastern literature like I do. And she would say, of course, slavery was bad. And of course, that's not a divinely written section of text. Right. Of course not. It's another ancient Near Eastern text. It's not required for her, this sort of inerrancy handed down by God sort of approach. It's not required because hers is a faith position. And that sort of thing, she's not militantly trying to take 3,000-year-old texts or 2,500-year-old texts and try to base laws and ethical systems upon them. And that's, I think that's another problematic aspect of this whole apologetic of God working with the people. Because one of the things that I hear all the time is, well, look, what was God going to do? This is how their economy functioned. Right. And if the economy functioned this way, then if God pulled slavery out, then the economy was just going to fall. So he had to, you know, work slowly and to condescend to the people and work it out. The problem is that that's not at all what we see in the biblical text. In that passage of Deuteronomy 15 and even Leviticus 25, there is a significant problem with, let's take Deuteronomy 15, go back to, I was your debt slave, Seth, and the 6 years have come and gone, and now you're getting ready to set me free. The law says in Deuteronomy 15 that you've got to give me all kinds of stuff that's yours, grain and wine and, you know, all these provisions. And the text recognizes the economic difficulty with this. And it says, like, wait a minute, Seth, you don't have that kind of money. I mean, the whole reason that I came and worked for you is because I didn't pay back my debt. Now you're essentially setting me free with all kinds of stuff. Like, how's that going to work economically? And God says, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about how you're going to pay that, how you're going to, you know, survive economically with that. I will bless you in your harvest. I will bless you supernaturally. In other words, I will supernaturally intervene to take care of this economic difficulty that I'm telling you to do. And the same thing is true with the yearly Sabbath, the 7-year Sabbath, where you're letting the land lie fallow for the entire year. People would ask, how in the world are we going to eat if we can't, you know, till the ground and grow crops? Is it? God says, I will send you such a blessing in the 6th year that you'll eat the 7th and the 8th year into the 9th. That's because I'm going to supernaturally provide for that. So this idea that God would not intervene supernaturally just runs directly against really the core of the text. God always promised to supernaturally intervene for his people. So it's quite a stretch to say that he couldn't do that.
It's the manna from heaven, God. It's the loaves and the fishes, God. We see this sort of miraculous provision all the time, right? The God who says, don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will take care of itself kind of thing. It doesn't really wash. Josh, can we talk about female slaves for just a moment specifically? And the offspring of female slaves, I mean, there were often horrific consequences for the daughters of female slaves in the biblical Old Testament, right?
Yeah, I mean, probably the one place that you can go to that talks about what happens to a daughter who's sold as a female slave, a maidservant, an ama in the Hebrew, is Exodus 21, starting in verse 7. So again, just kind of going from memory here, if a man goes into debt, just like we saw earlier in the passage, one of the things that he can do is sell his daughter as a concubine or as a wife, depending on the context. But she's being sold as a slave, as a female slave. And to us, that sounds horrific, and it is. This was standard practice during the period. So what would happen is the daughter would be sold. She wasn't given a choice in the matter. There have been apologists that have tried to argue that, well, wait, you know, doesn't the Greek say maybe she has a choice? It doesn't. It does not say that at all. In fact, it says quite soundly the opposite. But the daughter is sold by her father into concubinage or as a wife, just depending. And there are stipulations that are put in place to protect her, believe it or not. But again, doesn't protect her from being sold as a slave. Her status has changed. When she is sold, her status has changed. So the rationale behind this protection is that slaves could be used sexually. So a male slave, as we saw just a couple of verses earlier, can be used sexually to produce more slave children, right? He can be given a female slave to procreate with, but it doesn't devalue him. That process does not devalue him. And so, you know, being used sexually like that for producing more slaves doesn't, there's no detriment really to him in that sense. However, with a woman, great devaluation takes place when she has sex. And so being sold into this concubinage or into this type of female slavery for sexual purposes devalues her. And so now protections have to be put in place. So the father sells his daughter to a guy, and the guy determines he's not going to take him for himself. He's going to take him for his son. They can't both sleep with her. It has to be given to the son. Now, if for whatever reason, the text is unspecific about what this might be, but if she's no longer pleasing to her husband or to her master, she has to be either provided with her marital provisions, which are talked about in the text. If she's not provided with these things, the owner has to allow her to be redeemed by her family, to be bought back by her family. He can't sell her as a slave. In other words, her status has been changed. She's no longer just a slave. She's received a higher status because she's being used for procreation. And so she can't just be sold to a foreign nation or, you know, somewhere else as a slave.
She's still property. No, she's still sort of being passed around, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think this is one of the places that we've got to be very specific when we talk about property, because yeah, I mean, she's a slave, right? She may have a changed status, but she's still a slave and she's not free to leave. And I think the problem, this is one other thing that, you know, it's good to recognize in these discussions, is that when we say property, apologists will often come back and say property, they're not property, because look, you know, this is my phone. I can do whatever I want with my phone. I can smash it on the ground. I can do whatever. And, you know, you can't do that to a slave. You know, slaves, they don't have to work on the Sabbath, and there's punishments if you beat them, if you knock out an eye or a tooth, which are very severe things, by the way. Those aren't minor things, to knock out an eye or a tooth. But you can't just do whatever, so they can't be property. Well, no, they are. They definitely are. Being property does not equate to that property having no protections or no rights. So we don't need to go that far when we make these arguments that they're not treated like beat up old couches. Oftentimes, slaves in the ancient Near East had, I don't want to say by modern standards, they're not good lives by modern standards, but, you know, oftentimes they could conduct business for their master. They could, they were given, they could earn money. It's not really their money. It ultimately goes back to the master. But I think that recognizing the subtleties, the nuances of this in this argument allows us to make much stronger case, and it keeps there from being cracks, I think, in the argument.
So the idea that they're given food, shelter, even provision, some latitude, doesn't change the fact that they were still enslaved.
Exactly. That is exactly right. They can't leave.
I'm interested in the linking of sexuality and value, especially when it comes to Old Testament women. I don't know if you would agree with this. I thought it was a compelling argument that, like in the biblical Old Testament, when a woman was raped and her father was paid, I think it was 50 shekels or whatever, silver, it's because rape wasn't considered a crime of sexual violence against a woman. It was considered a property crime against the man.
That's exactly right.
So you would agree with that assessment?
Yeah. So when a man and a woman have adultery, commit adultery, the crime is against the husband. It's against the husband of the wife. That doesn't mean that they considered it to be okay, right, for the woman to they understood the harm that came to her. But the primary consideration in this was that what it devalued her, for example, the amount that she could bring to her family if she were to be married off, or it would be, you know, as you say, a crime against her husband from more of a property standpoint. That's just a reality of how that was the focus of that. So, that by itself is horrific from modern standards, from our progressive morality. And I think just staying with that type of an explanation in these conversations allows us to be able to say, look, how do you have this unchanging moral system if you have things like this going on? And I think that that allows for that argument to hold rather well.
One more short break when I come back. Anything else that we're getting wrong about the Bible? I'm going to continue to talk to Dr. Joshua Bowen on the other side of this. My patrons get this show totally commercial-free. They get the show a couple of days early. And if you would like to become a patron, thank you so much. Just go to patreon.com/Seth Andrews. Continuing my conversation with Dr. Joshua Bowen, who's done a deep dive, several deep dives, actually, into the Old Testament, the context of the languages in which the Bible was written, and how we can be more effective in the conversations that we're having. Anything else that sort of pops on your radar when we come to addressing the problems with the Bible, Old or New Testament, that you think that we get wrong when we're discussing things with Bible believers?
I think just in general, the approach is good. I guess what I would say is there's no reason to go what I would consider overboard with it. So there are places, for example, in Numbers chapter 5, that's a good example, the passage that talks about if you have an unfaithful wife, or you suspect, a husband suspects that he has an unfaithful wife, you know, there's a provision there in this very complicated passage where he can bring her before the priest, and the priest has this ritual that he goes through, and he takes dust from the floor of the tabernacle and puts it in this water. And then there's an oath that's taken by the woman. And she says, I have not slept with this man. And then she drinks the potion. I don't know if you're familiar with the passage I'm talking about.
The bitter water. Yeah.
That's right. And the text is complex, they're editing two different rituals together, two different versions of this ritual together. And so it's complex. But what the text talks about is if she has had sex, there are consequences for her reproductive organs, right? She's not going to be able to bear children. Now,
if she's had sex outside of marriage.
That's correct. If the husband's, you know, jealous inclinations are correct. This is a type of ordeal. We have something similar to this in Mesopotamia. So they have something called the river ordeal, where essentially it's a situation where we don't have witnesses. We don't have anybody that can confirm this is or is not the case. And so in that case, if we don't have witnesses, we can't prove it, the person is thrown into the river. And if they survive, if they swim out or whatever, then they're guiltless, right? But if the river consumes them, the river was considered a deity, and so the god took care of them, right? That's the idea. And so the same thing is true here in Numbers 5. It's you're allowing God, who sees everything, to pass judgment on the woman. Now, what I hear often is this is God condoning abortion, right? Or God endorsing abortion. I don't think we need to go that far. I think it's absolutely true that if this were actually carried out, and I'm not in any way convinced that it was, but if this ritual were actually carried out, there obviously would be cases where a woman would be pregnant and would lose the child, right? If we just follow the logic of the narrative.
Now, let me make sure that I'm tracking. We sort of digressed into the river, but when the woman in the Old Testament is brought before the council of men, she's forced to drink the bitter water. If she had had an adulterous relationship and was with child that was not of her husband, that child would be flushed out of her body on sight. Did I read that text correctly? She would abort
maybe not
the child.
On sight, but yeah, but I mean, ultimately.
Okay.
But the focus on the passage is not on the fetus. The focus is on her reproductive organs. And so I guess what I'm saying is, it's sort of in the same light with the Exodus 21 passage. There are definitely conclusions that one can draw. Yes, if there were a fetus in there, the fetus would die, and that would be abortive. But that's not what the text is aiming at. That's not what the text is trying to argue. So there's a sort of a consequential look and maybe an intentionality. What is it that the text is trying to do? The text is putting a punishment on the woman. Now, we don't need the text. I say we, like someone who's arguing against the fundamentalist apologist, doesn't need the text to focus on the fetus. It doesn't even really need this to be a real practice, a real ritual that was carried out. If you're looking at this text as the inspired, inerrant, infallible word of God handed down from a perfectly moral being who never changes in his morality, this is problematic in the same way that Exodus 21 passage is problematic. What I think is that there are instances where we don't need to take the text and to make it say something that it's not intending to say to make our point.
That's a messy one for those of us who are looking at ancient Hebrew, you know, thousands of years after it's been written. But if I'm understanding you, you're saying that the ejection of the fetus, the abortion, is a secondary, even a tertiary consequence. But it wasn't really about the baby itself. The punishment was specifically targeted to the woman and her reproductive system.
I think that's exactly right. And I think we run into problems. Someone will run into problems if they say, see, God is endorsing abortion. Because I think that what that does is that carries with it that's the point of the passage.
That God would say, all right, fine, I'll kill your baby as punishment, when the truth was the baby was probably incidental or at least secondary to the punishment.
But the thing is, you don't need to, in order to argue against this unchanging morality, this objective morality in the sense that it's argued, you don't need the text to be talking specifically about abortion. In the same way that going back to the Exodus passage, in Exodus 21, there's a whole section about the goring ox. And the goring ox scenario talks about if an ox who is known to gore is prone to, you know, goring people, and the owner doesn't take the necessary steps to keep it penned up or to keep it away from people, and the ox gores someone to death, then there's to be punishment to the owner of the ox. If the ox gores a free man or a free woman or a free boy or a free girl, then the owner is killed as punishment. If the ox gores a slave, he pays 30 shekels of silver to the owner of the slave. Now, that doesn't really need any commentary, right? That's pretty horrific from our vantage point, because you're saying that if you kill a free person, death. If you kill a slave, 30 shekels of silver. There's a differentiation in the value of the human being, right? The slave is considered to be less valuable. You don't need it to say anything more than that. You can let the text just say what it says to make the point that, look, our morality is more developed. And I'll just say John Collins wrote a book. It's a very easy to read book called What Are Biblical Values? John Collins, again, up at Yale Divinity School, brilliant Old Testament scholar. But these are the types of passages that he's addressing: violence in the Old Testament, slavery, rape, abortion, you know, the treatment of women. All of these things are being dealt with, and it's bad enough as it stands. We don't need to take it further than what the text actually says, because I think that puts us in a precarious position, because an apologist, a fundamentalist evangelical apologist, will pounce on anything that they consider to be incorrect and ignore everything that's clear and obvious. And so I think taking away that bit of arguable, you know, something that's debatable or even probably going too far with the text, so that it cuts them off at the knees and it doesn't allow this type of response.
Sure, we shoot too far and they say, hey, wait a minute, this is wrong, which becomes then a way to knock down credibility of the counter-apologist. And we've been guilty of that. We're guilty of being human and wanting things to fit in a box. And it's certainly hard to do today. You know, people argue in sound bites, don't they? We argue in tweets. We argue with these little jabs and zingers and one-liners. And the idea of consideration seems to be waning more and more. It's a bit discouraging. How do we combat that, I wonder? Do you get philosophical when it comes to having a discussion? Are these discussions even possible?
You know, what I have found recently, and I may just have the personality for this, I tend to be a people pleaser, if that resonates with your audience. So I find it much easier to go on, for example, channels of people that vehemently disagree with me, Christian apologist channels, and have these types of conversations, but in a very friendly, cordial way. The upside to it is that I'm making those types of connections, which I think is really, really important in the conversation to sort of bridge the gap. The difficulty, of course, is that I tend to not focus on the things that are going to make them feel uncomfortable. And so I tend to find places that I agree. And an interesting example of this is I did a debate, quote unquote, with Dr. Michael Brown. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but another ancient Near Eastern Hebrew Bible scholar. And it was on a show called Modern Day Debate. And we ended up talking for, I think, almost 2 hours, agreeing with each other, trying to find places that we connected on slavery, on the issue of slavery. And the problem is I caught so much flack from the atheist community and the agnostic community, because I didn't really hammer home, you know, let's really focus on Leviticus 25. I didn't do that because I didn't want the conversation to get too awkward. And that's, you know, there are pros and cons, I suppose.
So they're like, why didn't you get him? Why didn't you take him out? I mean, I feel that sometimes, you know, sometimes it is satisfying to see somebody who's, they paint themselves into a corner, and then you point out the fact that, hey, you got nowhere to go. I mean, I'll admit there are moments when I find satisfaction in that to be that guy.
It's interesting. The last thing I'll say about it is the guy that I co-host with on his channel, Skylar Fiction, he loves doing that sort of thing. He's really good at debating, and I'm terrible at debating. And so what I end up doing is doing these two-on-two debates with him. And I let, you know, I just kind of sit back, I mute, and I let him
tear into the bad cop.
And periodically I'll kind of come in and I'll say, you know, one of the things maybe we can think about, but you know, go ahead.
Oh, I'm lousy at debate, Josh. I mean, I'm much better at conversation storytelling. I can have the conversation, but, you know, debate requires a specific skill. And, you know, there are tactics and strategies and all of these other things that I don't really play in that sandbox. I mean, I've had a few of those conversations. A couple I was horrible and a couple I was okay. You know, it's just not really my wheelhouse.
And part of my problem is I have multiple sclerosis and it screws with my ability to think quickly. And I can't, and I lose my train of thought very, very quickly. I've probably lost it several times in this conversation.
Oh, fantastic.
And so it can look really bad if I have to pause or if I can't remember the question that was asked. So yeah.
Dr. Josh Bowen, how do the rest of us better participate in these types of discussions? Like if we're going to tool ourselves up, and I've got resources I'm always pitching to my audience. I talk about like the Great Courses Plus and some other things out there. But I mean, can they come to your channel to get into some of these deep dives into, you know, the ancient Near East and the Old Testament and the Torah and all those types of things? I'd like to sort of open those doors as wide as we can before we call it a day. Where would they find you in conversations that help them in these exchanges out there?
Yeah, we're at Digital Hammurabi. We have a website, digitalhammurabi.com, or our YouTube channel is just Digital Hammurabi.
Now, explain Hammurabi for everybody.
So Hammurabi was a king of Babylonia in the early second millennium BCE. He's incredibly powerful king for his time. And he's sort of, you know, you have the law code of Hammurabi, you have his conquests. And so he's sort of a big name figure. And actually, my wife, when she taught a course up at Hopkins, she wanted to talk about bringing ancient texts into the digital age. And so we were wrestling with what to call the course. And so she called it Hammurabi in the Digital Age. And when we started the YouTube channel a couple of years ago, I said, well, why don't we just call it Digital Hammurabi? So it kind of stuck.
So you host it together?
Yeah. She's really the one that does a lot of the work behind it, keeping it going. But the whole point of the channel is to provide free resources for people that are non-specialists to understand the ancient world, the ancient Near East, ancient Mesopotamia, Egypt, Syria, those places, and of course, Israel. So like I have a free Sumerian, learn to read Sumerian for the beginner course. That's actually the most popular series on our channel. So if you wanted to learn to read ancient Sumerian, our channel, it's all free. I've got Learn to Read Biblical Hebrew. I do that every Sunday. But, you know, we also have things like more focused on the Hebrew Bible. So prophecies, for example, like Ezekiel 26, you know, it talks about the prophecy of Tyre. Did it really fail? Yeah, it really did. I've got a video about that, and I've got a free paper that I put up on our website that explains how the prophecy actually did fail. Or we've got videos about the apocalypse. You know, what is apocalypticism and what did people actually think about? We have interviews on violence in the Old Testament. What we do is, we'll either make, I have a whole video series on the dating of Daniel. Is Daniel written in the 6th century BCE and it's prophecy, or is it written in the 2nd century after the fact? Well, spoilers, it's written after the fact, but we have a whole video series about that. But we have lots of scholars come on, scholars in the field of Egyptology and Assyriology and Hebrew Bible, and we do interviews with them and get them to talk about really important topics. So we just had, you know, Joel Baden come on and talk about the formation of the Pentateuch. We had John Collins come on and talk about violence in the Old Testament. We had Dr. Brendan Bentz come on and talk about who the Canaanites were, you know, the Canaanites in the Hebrew Bible. Were they really these awful, giant, wicked people? No, they weren't. We had an interview about child sacrifice in ancient Israel with Dr. Heath Durrell. So that's sort of what we do, is try to make those resources free and available. We've written a couple of books. Third one's going to be coming out very soon, the one on slavery. We wrote a companion to the Learn to Read Sumerian video series, and it's how to learn to read Sumerian. Really useful, I think, book. But they're all written to very popular audiences. They're all on Amazon.
There's no small talk in the Bowen household. You guys just sit around, you know, you're having breakfast and waffles and eggs, talking Sumerian. I mean, yeah, that's just how you guys roll. So.
We're quoting Super Y to the kids. That's what we're doing. Dora the Explorer.
Well, you know, we've sort of cracked the door open, and I'm going to put the links in the description box for everybody who wants to be able to go deeper, and that way they can find you and your work. Fascinating conversation, Dr. Josh Bowen. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, man.
Pleasure's been mine. Thank you, Seth, for having me on. It's been great.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.